Well, how is that even mime music? Well, I don't know. It is mime music. All right. So first of all, welcome to our show. We are doing a show about mime because, of course, we're a radio show. So we have to do a show about mime. I will say that it's probably not the craziest thing the show has ever done. And in fact, in my career, I one time had the Flying Karamazov brothers juggle on the air. Think about that. Juggling on the radio. But we did want to do a show about mime. I should say, just by way of introduction, you know how people say some of my best friends are blank, blank, blank? Well, growing up, some of my best friends were mimes. One of my best friends in high school actually left high school and went to Paris to study with the Etienne de Crew and came back. And I actually produced a mime show that he did. And I learned a lot about what it's like to be a mime anyway. And I was the kid in high school who hung around with the mimes. And, okay, the other mime that I kind of know is Mark Lynn Baker. Mark Lynn Baker, who's gone on to all kinds of movie stardom and Broadway stardom. He started out around here, and he did mime, and he was a street mime, and he would do stuff like pretend to fish out of the storm drains and stuff like that in whiteface. And whenever I bring this up with Mark, I run into him every once in a while, and I bring it up with him, and he tenses up visibly. And it's like, you know how James Cameron dropped Piranha 2 from his list of films that he directed at a certain point? You know, he just dropped the oldest one off. I feel like Mark is trying to drop his mime life off, and I see there's no reason for that, as you're going to see. Because one of the points we're going to make, and we're going to make it right now with just the perfect guest to do it, we're so honored and lucky to have with us Doug Jones, award-winning actor, best known for his roles in Hellboy and Hellboy 2, Pan's Labyrinth, and most recently, or very recently anyway, as the amphibian man in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, and currently starring also as Commander Saru on CBS's Star Trek Discovery. Doug is also a trained mime and contortionist, and he's joining us from studios in Toronto. And Doug, there's one more thing I have to say, which is before we get going here, which is as another layer of kind of, I hesitate to say insanity, but we actually do a regular feature, which we are doing today, called Radio for the Deaf, where we provide radio programming for a deaf audience. And the way we do this is that in the studio with me are two American Sign Language interpreters. So we're doing a show about mime that's going to be interpreted into American Sign Language by ASL interpreters. There's some meta way to talk about that, but it eludes me. So Doug Jones, I feel like after that windy introduction, I mean, the point I was leading up to is people think that they don't have mime in their lives, but then they go to movies like the ones that I just mentioned, and we're going to talk about other roles of yours that are like that and other roles that are like that in general. People watch a lot of mime. They just don't call it mime, right?
That would be correct, right? I feel that people communicate with visuals every day, just on the street. It doesn't have to be in a movie. So mime is a part of all of our lives, really. That's how I feel.
Yeah, but mime is a bigger part of your life than it is of many people's. And maybe you can just give us a sense. I mean, how did that come to be? I mean, as I said, I had a friend in high school who decided to be a mime, but I mean, he was like the only person I knew doing that. So how about you?
Right. Well, much like Mark Lynn Baker, your friend, when I mention mime, I kind of have to cringe and wonder who's going to throw what at me because people tend to hate mimes. But for me, it started in college at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. I lived in a dorm, and down the hall from me was Reed K. Steele, a senior when I was a freshman. And he ran the student-run mime troupe on campus called Mime Over Matter. Get it? And he saw how tall and lanky I was and how I talk with my hands all the time and was rather goofy in the lunchroom. So he asked me one day, have you heard of mime and would you come see one of our shows? I did, loved it. And then he asked me to audition for the troupe. I did. And so that became a freshman through senior year thing of mine at college. And then I developed my own solo act out of that as well. So that's how my beginnings happened. And then I right after I graduated college, I was a street mime at a theme park in Cincinnati, Ohio, Kings Island. And boy, that was an unforgiving summer. because your average theme, your people waiting in line for a roller coaster aren't really in the mood, maybe sometimes, for a quiet guy with a white painted face and black lines under his eyes. It scared the children to death. It really did. Why isn't he talking? Why isn't the clown talking? I'm not a clown. I couldn't say that. I couldn't talk. Very embarrassing.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about. So one of my two mime friends from my past, the one that I knew better, is this guy David. And David was a very small and slight adolescent. And he went to France, studied with Etienne de Crew. The young Jessica Lange was also in that class. And he came back, and there was one day where, and he really had, you know, had just conditioned himself. I mean, there's a lot of conditioning that goes into this. One day, for fun, two of the really big football players tried to hold David down, and they couldn't do it.
He wiggled out of it, did he?
Yeah, and there was also just a tremendous strength. I mean, you develop muscles, right, that nobody else develops.
Right. When you're holding poses, when you do illusions like leaning on a mantle that isn't there, or opening a window and climbing through it that isn't there, it does develop a muscle set that other people just don't use or develop, right?
His strength in certain ways was really startling. Well, now, I have to say something, which is that you've been in some scary movies and scary TV shows, The Strain, The Terror of Hallows Eve, Bye Bye Man, these are Hocus Pocus. These are some pretty, John Dies at the End, these are some pretty scary movies. The thing that you have been in, that you have done very early in your career, that is terrifying to me, utterly, starkly terrifying.
Was it a commercial?
Yes, it was the McDonald's moon guy.
I get two stories on that. Either people loved him or were terrified of him. Yeah,
I was really afraid of him. And you should say a little bit. Tell that story. Technically, you were the McDonald's Mac Tonight character, but this was sort of a crescent moon thing.
Right. It was some people call me the Moon Man. I was a human body with a crescent moon with a face on it for a head. And that was puppeteered by off-camera puppeteers and the mask makers. But that was one of my early gigs. Getting paid as an actor was that TV commercial campaign. But it was a huge success, and for those who weren't terrified of it. And it ran in a worldwide and went on for 3 years. I made 27 commercials as that character. And that was kind of the spot that I was discovered from, really, because Creature Effects people would come and help us work on those commercials from other shops, like Rick Baker's and Stan Winston's and Greg Canham's, like, you know, all those award-winning makeup artists that have their own shop would have people, we would borrow them for our commercial shoots, and they would go back to that shop, and then a movie or TV show would come through with a long, lanky alien character concept, and they would say, oh, I just worked with this guy, you know, who moves well in with a lot of crap on his face, and he doesn't complain about it. So I think we need, so the referral process started early for me with that. And the mime training, the mime background is what really kind of, I think, helped me along the way, because that art form is what woke my body up to understanding that you can communicate with things other than verbal words. We have a huge vocabulary visually, all of us do. And being a mime, you have to rely on that because you don't have words.
You know, a lot of these roles that you do, Doug, are roles for which you cannot prepare. I mean, no, let me put it a different way.
There
are
roles,
there are roles for which there is no template, you know?
No research, right.
If you're going to be Richard III, you can think, well, you know, I'll be kind of a little bit like Ian McKellen's Richard III, but I'll be different or something like that. But somebody says, look, you're going to be this fish guy, you know, whether that's Abe Sapien in Hellboy or the amphibian in The Shape of Water, you know, or you're going to be this guy in Pan's Labyrinth. I mean, what do you do? Well, there isn't an existing obvious vocabulary, so to speak, for these roles. So what do you do?
Right. Well, you do find out what you can from the script. Now, what you just mentioned, being that I was an animal man hybrid as Abe Sapien and the fish man from The Shape of Water as well, I do have something to pull from nature, a fish, right? I've seen fish. So Abe Sapien was more of a study of the fish that were in my home aquarium. Mm-hmm. I loved how their fins moved, how their curious heads were like darting around and their fins would glide, you know, elegantly behind them. It's like, okay, so that's what I gave Abe Sapien. Well, then when Guillermo del Toro, the same director, came back to me saying, I want you to play another fishman in The Shape of Water, the challenge was to make him not Abe Sapien. So we changed up the body language a bit and made him a bit more stoic, more heroic, more a cross between a superhero and a toreador from, you know, a matador with those sexy hip movements. I had to lead with my pelvis, sort of a thing, and not be so fluid in the hands with like fin, like, so I had to, that was more That was more because he was worshipped as a river god in, right. in the Amazon. That's the backstory of the amphibian man. From
and we eventually discover he's good in bed, so to speak.
Sure, sure. So I didn't want to play up the fish too much because that then it turns into something else. Mm-hmm. So we played up more of the mysterious river god, is he or isn't he, kind of thing with a sexy heroic stance was the idea.
You know, it seems to me that another odd paradox of this is that training as a mime, when you train as a mime, you are training essentially to use your body in a pretty much direct and uncontained by anything else way. In other words, in fact, there's sort of, you know, a lot of the conventions of mime are about, you know, nothing mm-hmm. to distract you from the movements of the body itself, including, you know, the white face, I guess, is sort of part of that. But you wind up in a lot of these roles where they're just putting crap all over you, right?
yes.
And, yeah. Well, talk about that.
Well, I find that so much of my early mime training involved facial expression as well. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, like that's, and I think that's why the white face with the black lines on it, because it does heighten your eyebrow movement, your eye movement, your mouth movement. If they're outlined and, you know, if there are lines and that indicate, they respond. Those lines respond very well to your facial expressions and actually help you tell that nonverbal story. So when you move from that into playing a creature that has, you know, layers of latex or silicone makeup over your face, it's harder to get those expressions through. So you do need to rely on a tilt of the head, a glance, all of that positioning language that will indicate an emotion or a feeling. And as an actor, too, this is what I have to combine the actor Dougie. So I really have to feel those things in order for it to come out of my body correctly and with convincingly for an audience. So with that, you know, comes also hand expressions and gestures and a posture that was either, you know, erect and proud or huddled over and getting sickly or, you know, anything can come into play there.
And as Shakira has taught us, your hips cannot lie.
They
must not.
Exactly.
Lie.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
So, you know, it's tough to do the Doug Jones audio montage highlight reel, but you know what? We're going to do it.
What happened to going with your gut? Well, my gut is telling me to turn things around. My gut is telling me that this is what I should do.
It is well known that my species has the ability to sense the coming of death. I do not sense it today.
You buck-tooth, mop-rind, firefly from hell! I've waited centuries to say that.
She's like me.
A creature from another world.
Yeah, it doesn't work as audio, but
you know, I've never just listened to myself like that before. Those were four distinctly different voices,
yes,
so thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about actor Dougie. I think you just called him that. I'm going to tell you a pretentious name-dropping story, and it begins this way. I was having lunch with James Earl Jones, and that's actually really true. This is a long, long time ago. He's down in New Haven to play either Timon of Athens or Timon of Athens. I think that year it was Timon. But anyway, and this is the 1980s. And so I said to him something about, well, you know, you play Darth Vader in the movie. And he goes, I don't play Darth Vader. There's an actor named David Prowse who plays Darth Vader. I supply the voice for Darth Vader. And I would imagine to you that's a pretty important distinction and that you also are saying, you know, huzzah, James Earl Jones.
You're right. I've been voiced over only a couple times, but there were a couple of key times that almost ruined me. I didn't want to be known as the guy who gets voiced over.
Right.
Because, you know, my 32-year career, I've been providing my own voice for almost every character, really, except for the first Hellboy movie. I wasn't a name at that time, and so David Hyde Pierce was, and so the studio thought it would be, you know, a good marketing plan to get a name actor tied to that character that would be on the poster of the movie with Hellboy, with Ron Perlman. So I was voiced over by David Hyde Pierce in Hellboy 1, but I got my own voice back for Hellboy 2. That's all me. And then the Silver Surfer as well, I was voiced over by Lawrence Fishburne. But again, and that was kind of a surprise to me. I didn't know that until the Hollywood Reporter said so. I was like, what? Mm-hmm. So now I'm kind of protected now. Going into a film or TV show, that's a part of the deal. I will be voicing this myself, or you'll find someone else. I just think that's how it has to be now.
Yeah.
It's hard. I don't want to be known as Dub Jones.
Right. Plus, we got the audio reel to prove it. You know that, yeah. Those are very distinct, as you say, very, very distinct characters. So I feel as though that, this is another pretentious question, that kinesis, the movement is the thing that's one of the things that's hardest to talk about. I used to teach writing, and one thing I would do is take my writing class to a dance class and I write what you see, because movement has, it's not like color or sound. It doesn't have necessarily as big a vocabulary that goes with it. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, you know, Guillermo del Toro, if he wants you to, I think he's got to direct you. I would imagine finding the language to talk about that, given the fact that Guillermo del Toro and the other directors you work with, you know, they're not Alvin Ailey or something. I don't know. What do they tell you?
Right. Well, Guillermo is great at collaborating, and he does love the mime part of me. He's often told people, you know, on film sets, like, you know, when someone's trying to, maybe even a cameraman is trying to get me to do something so the light shines better on me or whatever, he might say, trust Dougie, he's a mime. He's said that many times on the set, so I really appreciate that part of him. And if he'll tell me, he wants me to get from point A to point B. He'll map out the, you know, the blocking and the choreography of the scene, but then he'll let me play and fill in the gaps between those two points. He's very, very good about just letting me have my. That's why he brings me on. Is he trusts what I bring in the room with me? Which he trusts any actor he brings in. So I love that about him. Another director that I really did love working with was in Hocus Pocus, Kenny Ortega, who was a dance choreographer before a film director. He'd also directed Newsies, big musical movie, and he loved collaborating with shapes and silhouettes. So Billy Butcherson, also a very physical role for me. I'm a zombie who woke up after 300 years of being dead. By the way, this is our 25th anniversary this year for that movie. So,
woohoo!
Yeah, I know.
It's a good excuse for a party, although...
any day, right? Right? So I did enjoy a director like that who was also very visual. And Guillermo del Toro he is fascinated by my tall skinniness for some reason. Mm-hmm. So these creatures that he keeps creating that are these long, lanky fellows and ladies from Crimson Peak. I was two of his ghost ladies in that as well.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that.
So he'll even say sometimes, Crimson Peak's a great example. When I was the mother ghost floating down the hallway at the beginning of the movie, about to haunt the young character who became Mia Wasikowska later in the movie when she grew up, I'm floating down the hallway with my hands sort of floating in front of me, and he said, "Dougie, more piano fingers." So he wanted to see my fingers like moving more for whatever reason. So piano fingers is something I've heard many times out of his mouth.
Right. Well, I would say Guillermo del Toro, and no offense intended here, but is probably one of the few people here in the 21st century who routinely says, "Trust him, he's a mime."
one of the very few.
Just words that don't get said that often,
they
probably.
They don't get said that much. That's right.
Obviously, you've now have this wonderful, enviable career. I'm sort of wondering about, like the guys that I grew up with who were classical mimes, and my good friend David, he stopped being a classical mime at a certain point. But I mean, I don't know. Is it this the way that you're doing this? Is this sort of the way that you live and thrive and survive and prosper as a mime? Can you just be a mime?
Well, I've done both. I do appreciate being able to take the mime skills and putting it into a character that you're not expecting a mime from. Yes.
Yeah.
But I also, I played a classic white-faced, black lines around the eyes mime with a striped shirt and a leotard on. I did a sketch in Living Color with Damon Wayans' as Homie the Clown, where he beat me over the head in the park. Because, a clown facing off with a mime, that's
right.
Funny.
Mm-hmm.
I also did a guest star role on an old show called The Nut House. It was on for, I think it was canceled after four episodes. It was with Harvey Korman and Cloris Leachman, a hilarious show. And The gag I did on that was I was a mime outside the street and somebody walked by and stepped on my foot and I yelled, ah, and I started going into a big rant. Yeah. I did a couple commercials too, a lot of commercials. One for Trex Outdoor Decking, where I was on somebody's outdoor deck acting out all of the attributes of Trex decking, that it's, you know, it's not wood or it's something. And this night, and then the dog chases me off. And I did a Toyota commercial too, where I was a mime, street miming in front of some little girl, and all of a sudden a Toyota truck drives by, and I try to lasso it, and with my fake rope, it drags me down the street. So basically, as a mime, everything I've done on film, TV or film as a mime, has been to make fun of the mime. You know what I mean? To abuse the mime. So when you're, because I guess it's that thing that, you know, people don't like being followed around the park, being made fun of by a mime. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to portray a mime on film, you must make fun of him. So that's fine. But I think the more satisfaction for me has been, yeah, to take the mime skills and put it into a creature from another world and embody some sort of fantastical beast that no one would expect.
Are you using mime training for Commander Saru on Star Trek Discovery?
Well, again, yes, being very much aware of my body from head to toe, mm-hmm. that's yes, I would say yes. This is another, here's the challenge now, after being an actor for 32 years, every character I take on that is otherworldly, mm-hmm. I have to make him different than the last one I played,
yep.
and the last one. So what makes this alien move differently? Well, thank heaven, something wonderful and magical happened in the wardrobe or the costume department when I was getting my first fittings done. They put me up in hoof boots. Like, so my species, Kelpians, they have hoof feet, like a gazelle. So these shoes they made for me are like something that I think Lady Gaga has worn on stage before. It's like a high heel shoe without a heel under it. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of balancing on the balls of your feet. So when I put those on for the first time and tried to walk around, my pelvis kind of went forward to keep my balance, and my arms dangled slightly behind my hips instead of right next to them. So that created a supermodel walk, sort of like leading with the pelvis again, and then my arms swaying side to side instead of like a normal walking where your arms are going in opposition of your legs. They were going side to side behind me. So I let that swish with my hands kind of being fluid as they went side to side, and it became a very signature walk very quickly.
Now I'm on your IMDb page just so I can sort of see what's coming up. Looks like we get some vampire stuff coming up. Nosferatu in post-production.
Okay. Yes.
What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
Okay, talk about this.
I'm excited about both of those things. Nosferatu is, he's a character, the Count Orlok, a.k.a. Nosferatu, is a character I've wanted to play ever since I was first saw it. I was like, oh my gosh. I've always been entranced by vampires, but you know, the young pretty ones are something that I figured I would never, I can't sparkle. So I'm too old and gross for that. So Count Orlok is old and gross. I thought, oh, I can play him. And I understand him because he doesn't really know he's old and gross. He's an aristocrat from the days of yore. And I don't think he knows he's faded. So, I really connected with him emotionally, and so getting to play him in a remake that is coming out next year, 2019. I'm here; post production will be completed by December, so the distribution will happen shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. We did it; it was they're calling it a remix, green screen element in every shot of the movie. So that means that those green screen elements are going to be pulled from the original film. So I got to play in the environment that Max Schreck got to play the character in back in 1922. I'm very excited about this. Mm-hmm. So, and then What We Do in the Shadows, that hilarious movie that came out of the that team from, or was it New Zealand?
New Zealand.
They are developing a TV show based on the same story. So I was in the pilot episode, and it has been sold, and now will be coming out on FX channel. I'm not sure the dates on that. When it starts airing, but I am in the first episode, and I play a baron from the old world, and it is hilarious. I don't want to spoil anything else on that one. I don't know I don't know if I was even allowed to tell you that much, but right. but you'll see me in a makeup that goes from head to toe.
All right. Well, the good news is it just looks like, I mean, you're going to, I can see other projects here. You're going to keep working, and that's the best news of all. and you've certainly established yourself as someone who can do very, very, very special things. And we're very honored, Doug Jones, to have you on our show today. You've been a great guest and a great gateway, a gateway drug into mime.
It starts here and then gets worse?
Something along those lines. So we're going to be talking to Richard Knight in the next segment. We're continuing to talk about mime here, but we're going to take a little break before we do that. Here comes some music. We're going to say goodbye to Doug and hello, music. Before we get to Richard Knight, I have to say, I don't usually say this, but if there's any way that you can go over to our Facebook page right now, the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page, and see the Radio for the Deaf version of this, you should, just because, because in fact Doug Jones was recorded yesterday, I could watch our wonderful interpreters, Mary Sue and Heidi, doing this. And it's okay, ASL interpretation obviously is not mime, but they have to use a lot of the same skills in some ways. They have to convey a tremendous amount of information and coloration, emotional coloration, without actually using any words. And so they're doing this amazing job. It's so much fun to watch them. So watching them talk about the thing that or interpret about the thing that we are discussing and using so many of the same skill sets is, I don't know, it's pretty mesmerizing. So, yes, our Radio for the Deaf feed is over there on the Colin McEnroe Show page. It's Mary Sue and Heidi, sorry. Okay, so here we go. We're going to talk to Richard Knight. Richard Knight has a tremendous background in classical mime. He's a mime artist, instructor, and physical comedy expert, currently working at the very prestigious East 15 Acting School on physical comedy. He's the author of Mime the Gap, Techniques in Mime and Movement. Welcome to our conversation, Richard Knight.
Hello, Colin.
So maybe just to begin, there are probably easier ways to make your way in the world than being a mime. But if you love it, if you have a passion for it, you probably have no choice but to do it. What kindled this passion in you? What made you want to do this with at least a lot of your life?
Yes, I was dyslexic as a kid.
Yeah.
And I wasn't very good at maths or English. And so I couldn't deal with numbers. It's kind of like being word blind. And so when you're kind of like that, you see the world in a physical sense. So I started to look at sports and play sports. I played lots of games and I realized that I could actually do very well physically. And hence I picked up breakdancing. And then I thought, wow, this was in the 80s. And breakdancing was very popular, hence the moonwalk. And I actually picked it up very, very quickly. And then people were saying, hey, you're really good. I was going, no, I want to be an actor. And they said, oh, no, you should do mime. And then I realized, yeah, not everyone can do this. So that's how I started it, from being dyslexic.
You know, you trained with some of the famous French masters. And we're also a little bit later going to be talking about Etienne Ducroux and about Marcel Marceau. You trained with Philippe Gollier, I think, among other people. What is it about France? And I mean, why are there not famous British or Italian mime masters besides you? I mean, what's the French connection? Does it make any sense or is it just a random occurrence?
Yeah, it does make sense. It goes back a long way. I mean, the traditions go back, you know, all the way like 1700 BC, but eventually even from Italy, but eventually it travels to France. And there's a guy called Jacques Copeau who was looking at the theatre. Theatre came out in the turn of the century, 19th century, and it was all very, you know, fake and like fake scenery and rolling up the clouds come in or moving scenery. And he was thinking, no, there's got to be something more to this. And so he experimented with masks and tried to create theatre through the body. And then Etienne Ducroux, who trained Marcel Marceau, he picked this up and he said, yes, I want to separate mime from theatre and dance. So he codified it and he called it corporeal mime. Jacques Lecoq also was inspired by Capote, and he thought, no, I'm going to free the actor physically so they can explore and do self-devised theatre, and the chair could mean a racing horse or a rocket or anything like that. And so it actually, from Jacques Capote, who was looking at it, came across, and he thought, yeah, I'd like to, you know, pick this up. But even before that, you've got the great Pieros, which was inspired from Italy, from the Commedia dell'arte, from a character called Pegolino. And the French like to stylize things. And they, instead of this Pierrot character who had this, or Pegolino had these hand-me-down clothes, it goes into this Pierrot, which is wearing these long, beautiful draped tunic and trousers. And then it was about to play all parts just using your body. So it was storytelling through the body. So that's where the kind of roots of the French got into it. And of course, Marcel Marceau made it famous.
Right.
And from then, now we've got this stereotyped of stripy top, white face. That's mine. That's how we see the connection.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about that stereotype. In fact, rather than have me or you talk about that stereotype, we send somebody out onto the green in New Haven or somewhere in New Haven to ask people how they feel about mimes. Richard, some of this is going to hurt, but we're gonna fix it up after. Let's hear what they had to say.
How do you feel about mimes?
I think they're pretty interesting. They're sort of like creating objects that really aren't there. So I think it's this cool how like they just create their own space out of nothing.
They're kind of creepy and weird because, I mean, they're just like describing things, but they're not actually doing it.
I think they're pretty interesting people, how they can take everyday life situations and create their own vision of how they see it.
I think mimes are weird but awesome.
What's weird about them?
I mean, it's an art form that we don't see a whole lot of these days. I certainly don't run into it very often. And so being a little bit offbeat and retro like that is what's making people be a little bit creeped out.
I find them kind of charming in an old school way. I think that they bring back a type of theater that we don't see anymore.
Some people have described them as antiquated or even creepy. You don't think any of those things?
I mean, I think creepy is a good thing. Also antiquated, those are all fine adjectives as far as I'm concerned. It's probably a lost art.
All right, Richard Knight, there was good and there was bad, certainly nothing that you haven't heard before.
No.
So go ahead, react to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth in what they're saying as well. Because since Marcel Marceau, you know, especially 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even the 80s, he created this Bip character, which is from the last great Pierrot, and hence you have the white face, which is a mask. And then he had a bit of stripy top, but not a lot. And then became so popular, everyone thought, yeah, French, because he's French. Well, I'll wear a beret. I'll wear a stripy top. I'll wear white gloves. And then they took it out onto the streets. And what we get now is we get like a mass repetition of, you know, what people saw. And they try to do, you know, the walking in the wind, the glass box, all these kind of classics, which has now become a cliche. And the art form has kind of got a bit distorted, you know, thanks to It, Stephen King's It, mm-hmm. The makeup and the grotesqueness of it all. And because of the cliche, you're going to see a lot of that. I mean, I've certainly done a lot of TV stuff where, you know, people are just having a go and rubbishing mimes and, you know, hey, mime, get away, you're scary. And because also a white face very close up to someone takes it away from the stage, which it was originally intended to reach a crowd, you know, of hundreds or even thousands. Even if it was on the street, it was to reach a crowd in the theater. So when it's up and close and personal, it feels a bit creepy. So it is a lost art form as well, is what they were saying. Doug was saying that there's not many of us around, and that's very true as well. And I think the white face in particular, it comes from a long traditional, and that may be a bit dated, but you don't have to wear a white face to do mime. It's not about the white face. That's from a tradition from performing in the theatre. I mean, even Chaplin and Buster Keaton had a white face. It comes from that kind of old tradition. They were inspired by that as well.
I mean, in the starting in the 1990s or around the 1990s, here in the U.S. and perhaps also in the U.K., there started to be something that we called neo-vaudeville. And it was kind of, I think, a real reaction against the highly digitized culture that our kids were growing up with. And I brought my son to a lot of things like the Flying Karamazovs, who are jugglers, you know, and a lot of sort of vaudeville type stage acts. And I think mime is in there somewhere, too. There was a little bit of a reaction formation against how sleek and digital and pre-planned and not fleshly and not of this world children's culture in particular had become. And I would imagine that what you do would benefit from – you heard it even in some of those people talking in New Haven, that there was a way in which it harked back to a more humanistic kind of entertainment.
Yes, definitely. You know, back in the day, a mime, you know, could the subtlest nuance, they could understand what the emotion was. Nowadays, with digital TV and stuff, everything's really quick. But in those days, they didn't have TV or anything digital like that. So for subtle, you know, move of the eyebrow or the move of the fingers, everything was precise and everything had a meaning or the emotion of it. We don't have any actual records of the great Pierrots at the time, but that's the kind of thing which the audience could really pick up, and they could really feel the resonance of what a feeling was about or what emotion was about, which really conveyed the story. And a lot of that has been lost, and now we just get the, you know, walking in the wind, trapped in a glass box, and the white face, and so we get a reaction to that.
You know, I just want to mention as an aside, one of the weird places that there's been this incredible mime ascendancy has been in the world of particularly African-American Christian churches, but sort of evangelical Christian churches generally. There are these mime ministries. There are these videos of kind of mime dancing being done to gospel songs that have like 3.3 million views. There's this whole other world. And they're in whiteface, and they're doing – they look kind of more or less like classic mimes. So I guess, Richard, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you sort of a Doug Jones question, which is one of the things that happens for someone like you, who has studied so much the way a body moves, is that the film industry comes knocking on your door to ask you questions or see if you can help out getting a body to move that's not really a human body. So you've been recruited to work with people like Andy Serkis, best known as Gollum, but on the Avengers. And it is that whole idea, right? How do you make a body move if it isn't just a natural human body?
I think to do that, you've first got to understand how the human body works. And then you can go, okay, if this is how the human body works. So the human body is actually quite fluid. So when we're looking at Ultron and stuff, we're looking at the movement, which isn't fluid. So there's lots of stops and starts, which is robotic. You know, if you break a leg, you know, it gets dragged along. What happens if... What Andy did, he got me to put on one foot a skateboard, and I had to, like, because this was motion capture. So then when I was walking away as a robot, one leg is actually moving on the ground and the other leg is being smoothly dragged along by a skateboard. So things like that is going to help break up the human natural movements. So, or sometimes it could be like two people are holding onto my legs and I've still got to move in the opposite to fluid, which is a rigid or, you know, jerky way. So ultimately you can only use your body, but you've got to find the essence or a resonance of something else, which is solid, rigid, metal-like, or something that has been damaged but still has that kind of quality. So ultimately, in the end, you've got to play around with things. But you've just got to find the quality of something. Sometimes I look at something like it could be, say, like a metal screwdriver or something, and I feel it and I touch it and I try and find what is that quality that is – that makes it metal. And I go, oh, it's smooth, it's strong, it's rigid. Okay, let's see if I can recreate that in my physicality. So that's the kind of approaches, you know, you'd have to, you know, work with And that's how I like to approach it.
All right. We're going to take a little break. We'll have more of Richard Knight on the other side of that break. Also joining us, Sean Nguyen. We really do have to talk about Marcel Marceau, who really was the gateway drug for most of us to mime in mass culture. Change me, moms and mannequins, moms and mannequins, moms and mannequins. I see them all around me, moms and mannequins, but they can't see what I see. I won't let them in, I won't let them change me, moms and mannequins, moms and mannequins. Let me take just a moment to thank all kinds of people, starting with Heidi and Mary Sue and Carlos Mejia, who were all involved in the last two segments in which we try to do something where we bring a version of radio to a deaf audience. We call it Radio for the Deaf. You can see it on the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. It seems uniquely adapted or appropriate anyway that we should be doing it on a show about mime. So think about that, a radio show about mime, which is interpreted for a deaf audience. Well, I think only we would do that. And so Jonathan McNichol's been on the board today. Josh Nalea is the person who conceived of and produced this show and did a wonderful job as well. And tomorrow we have, I think, a conversation that's good. I've already recorded it, so I know it goes very deep, a conversation with the musician, composer Noah Behrman about his latest oeuvre. And it's one that incorporates some very shadowy elements, both a disease that he has struggled with his entire life that affects his piano playing, and the murder of one of the performers on this album he's just put out. So anyway, I encourage you to listen. Okay, so we got to talk quickly about Marcel Marceau. I just have to quickly make a quick confession, and maybe Richard and Sean Nguyen won't even want to talk to me after I do. But, you know, you go to Père Lachaise and you find Marcel Marceau's grave, and you have to decide whether you're the kind of person who insists on standing next to the grave and having his picture taken, like opening up an invisible umbrella or something. And unfortunately, I turned out to be that kind of person when I went to Père Lachaise. And I thought, I am now the like 10 millionth jerk to stand next to this grave and insist on acting like a mime. But there you go. So Richard Knight is still with us, maybe, unless he hung up after that.
I'm still here.
Mime artist and instructor in physical comedy at the prestigious East 15 Acting School. He's the author of Mime the Gap, Techniques in Mime and Movement. Sean Nguyen, writer, producer for Youth Radio, and a multimedia artist. She's the author of A 20-Minute Silence, Followed by Applause. Sean, we're going to talk about Marceau here. I am old enough so that I remember seeing him on the Red Skelton show. Red Skelton was a guy who kind of made a vaudeville transition from having done a lot of what would have been called pantomime to being a network comedy star. Marcel performed on the Ed Sullivan show, which is as big as things got. But I can't really say that I knew too much about him. But to what degree was he the person who brought mime into a mainstream American audience?
Yeah, Marcel Marceau performed for over 60 years. He started after World War II and performed almost up until his death. It's funny because since writing this book, so many people have come up to me to say that they saw him, you know, perform in their school auditorium or at the local theater. And he was really going like 200 shows a year, 300 shows a year at the peak of his life. In addition to being like physically ubiquitous, circling the globe, as you said, he went on talk shows, he gave interviews, he wrote forewords to books, he showed up in movies like movies by Mel Brooks or in Barbarella. Like, he sort of positioned himself as this worldwide ambassador to mime.
You know, I think, Richard, and you kind of, I think, alluded to this in the previous segment, there's a way in which we segregate mime and we think of it as something that Marcel Marceau did and anybody else, Shields and Yarnell, or people who kind of seemed like Marcel Marceau. But Richard, I would assume Marcel felt as though he had as much in common with Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton as he did with, you know, somebody doing classical mime.
Yes, absolutely. Basically, he was a great fan of Charlie Chaplin, and he got a lot of inspiration from him. And also, you know, Stan Laurel as well, because there's a nice photo of him pointing to Stan and mimicking him. But yeah, definitely, you know, he loved the old, you know, it's the physical comedy, especially from the silent movie period, where the art of gesture, as an example, or body posture, like Chaplin, he was very meticulous to make sure that every single gesture meant exactly what it was supposed to mean. As an example, Chaplin in City Lights, he was trying to teach this blind girl to present a flower, and he did something like 685 takes because she couldn't get it right. And Chaplin was always trying to teach her how to present the flower right to him. And Marcel Marceau was very similar. He studied with de Croo, and every single part of his body, you can see in his isolations, his facial expressions, the amount of time, the rhythm, everything is perfected down to the last detail.
So Sean Wen, you know, at the peak of his fame in America, Marcel Marceau was famous enough so that he could do a cameo on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and nobody had to say who he was. Everybody got the joke. And was he world famous? Was he an international star? Did people outside the Western world know who he was?
Yeah, absolutely. No, there are stories about him performing in Vietnam after the Vietnam War, or performing in China and Japan. Not only was he, you know, traveling all over the world, but I think in some ways, when I was talking to his students in France, they felt like his fame, you know, came out of the Americans, out of his love and popularity in America. I mean, in aligning himself with Chaplin and Buster Keaton rather than with de Croo, he was trying to position himself more as an American populist icon.
And speaking of American populist icons and looking towards the future instead of looking towards the past at Keaton and Chaplin, he had an influence on Michael Jackson. I mean, the first time I saw Michael Jackson do the moonwalk, just because I grew up around two classical mimes, I thought, oh. So, but maybe you can flesh that out a little bit for us, Sean.
Michael Jackson was very open about modeling his moonwalk after Marcel Marceau's Walking Against the Wind. And in the 90s, there was like a famous HBO special between Michael Jackson and Marcel Marceau where, you know, basically they mime towards each other. And, you know, Marcel Marceau makes this announcement, this is the king of pop meeting the king of mime. It was met with a lot of fanfare.
You know, there's a way in which you look at Marceau in particular and his classic white face, and there often are the kind of hints of teardrops or something on them. You write that you say that Marceau actually was in many ways a somewhat sad person who had a lot of problems with his personal relationships having to do with oral communication.
You know, it's funny. I was sort of thinking about that, about whether or not Marceau is a sad clown or if he is a pure figure in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly he had sort of a troubled personal life. He had three different marriages. He traveled so much and performed so much that it really put a strain on his interpersonal relationships. But, you know, I also in some ways think that, you know, rather than being a sad clown, Marceau is more of the Harlequin figure. Mm-hmm. In that, like, you know, Harlequin is probably the best known of the Commedia dell'arte characters. He, you know, is very physically agile, and he steals Columbina from Pierrot. You know, Marceau was a little bit of a Lothario, and so I think that it's not totally fair to say that he was a Pierrot himself.
That's right. His last wife, I believe, was 19 years old when he was in his 50s.
When they met, yes.
We should quickly say, we're almost out of time here. I don't think I have time for it. I did want to just, Sean, quickly say, in addition to everything else, this guy was pretty heroic, right? He was 16 years old when the Nazis occupied France, and he did things to save people. I don't know if you can just say that in 60 seconds.
Marcel Marceau was a hero in the French Resistance. He famously smuggled Jewish children from an orphanage over the Swiss Alps into safety. He would forge papers to make them seem younger so that they weren't targeted by concentration camps. He was very active in the French Resistance, as was his older brother.
All right. Well, this is all fascinating stuff, and we've been so lucky to have so many wonderful guests. Doug Jones, Richard Knight, his book is Mime the Gap, Techniques in Mime and Movement, and Sean Wen, whose book is A 20-Minute Silence, followed by Applause. Sean Wen, writer and producer for Youth Radio and a multimedia artist. All right. So we have to stop there, but thanks for listening. If you missed any of the show, I would really encourage you to go back and experience the beginning of the show over at the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page, simply because you can see our wonderful interpreters actually interpreting mime issues anyway through American Sign Language.